Hey, hey, have you heard? It's your host, Chris DeMakes, and I'm headed back to the Punk Rock Museum. That's right, the powers that be have invited me back, and I couldn't be more excited. Allow me to be your guide as we wind through 5 decades of punk rock history, merchandise, and memorabilia. Cinco de Mayo weekend, Friday, May 3rd, Saturday, May 4th, and Sunday, May 5th. There'll be 2 tours each day at 12:30 p.m. and 4 p.m. And the best part for me is you. Your stories, your questions, your experiences. Yep, some of you old punkers have taught this guy a thing or two on these tours, and I love it. Head over to thepunkrockmuseum.com for tickets. Don't miss out. Only 30 spots per tour. Get your tickets now at thepunkrockmuseum.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to The Journey. I'm your host, Chris DeMakes. And this is where I pick the brains of your favorite musicians about their musical paths, from the very beginning and throughout the years, up until the present. How they got from point A to point B, from their earliest musical memories, that very first song they remember hearing, to who influenced and inspired them. The moment they knew they wanted to be a performer, what led them to their instrument of choice, embarrassing first recordings, performances, and everything in between. When they fully realized this was a pure, unadulterated passion, way more than just a fleeting hobby or something they enjoyed in passing. We go deep and get the inside scoop of how, why, and when this all began. No two stories are the same, each unique to the individuals telling them, and everyone as fascinating as the next. So join me now as we embark on another journey. Well, hey everyone, welcome to another journey. And man, I am excited, really excited about this one because this is my first tandem journey. We're getting two guests today, drummer Jesse Bavona from The Interrupters and his brother, Justin Bavona, the bassist for The Interrupters. How are you guys doing today?
Hey, we're doing great, Chris. How you doing?
I'm doing great. It's good. It's really, really good to see you. It's been a hot minute for everybody that's been out of the touring game for a while. So it's good to actually be able to see your faces. Well, I want to take the listeners all the way back. And, you know, I guess before we dive in, I have to say something. And I mean this with the most sincere I can possibly be. I've never seen two twins ever hang out like you guys do. We'd be doing Warped Tour together. There you were. You'd be going to the bathroom, not in the same stall, but you'd go to the bathroom. You'd be at catering next to each other in line. You'd come hang out on the Less Than Jake bus. We'd be hanging out, having a couple drinks. You'd be together, go to your bus. You'd be together. And, you know, as a lot of people know, there's that common bond that twins have that just, unless you're a twin, you won't understand. So I thought it was kind of cool to have you both on and take us all back. What were your earliest memories, either individually or together, music-wise? Like, did you see someone on TV? Was it your parents playing music in the house? Do you remember? And I'm going to be saying your names a lot because we got two of you sound alike. We'll go with Jesse first.
Yeah, well, so we grew up in a musical household. So starting with our grandfather, he was a jazz musician back in the 30s, 40s, all the way up until he passed away in the mid-90s. And our dad, also a trumpet player, a trombone player, and a recording engineer. So growing up, there was a studio in the house, so there was instruments in the house. And so earliest memories, they're kind of foggy because it was just omnipresent. Music was always around. Our dad hung out with his musician buddies all the time. He had recording projects, so they'd be coming in and out of the house, like, recording. And we were just, it was just there. So, like, when we started playing music, our hands weren't forced at it. It was more, oh, like, he brought home a guitar and a bass one day. And we had a drum set in the house already. Kevin had been dicking around on that. I was dicking around that as well. But once, like, the guitar and bass came into the house, Kevin really gravitated toward that. And since I was already on drums, Justin gravitated toward the bass.
And how many years older is Kevin than you guys?
He's 3 years older.
Okay, and I believe, do you have an older brother as well?
We have an older sister who is another, like, 2 years older than him.
Okay. Was she into music at all?
She's not. She's the book smarts one. She's like fluent in three languages. She's got a doctorate, a master's degree. Like, but she did, one year, she did learn keyboards and she played a couple shows with us.
Yeah.
She got to play the El Rey and the Palladium in LA with us and the Whiskey.
not exactly the bar down the street. Those are like real gigs.
She's also a huge inspiration for all of us because being the older sister, she would introduce us to music. Like, I remember her having like Hepcat Right on Time and being like, oh, what's that? And all like the Hellcat compilations and the Punk-O-Rama compilations. And she's the one that showed us like Propagandy when we were 10 years old. And she's always been a very important in our musical journey.
I've always said, and I again mean this with from the heart, I've always said that bands that have brothers or twins, they have this unfair advantage. You guys are even taking that further now. Your grandfather, your dad, you got three brothers in the band, because I'm not saying this to blow smoke, guys. I've told this to a number of people. Your band is so tight. It's incredible. And it's that pulse, I feel, of being brothers, especially being twins, that you're just so connected. It's incredible. So were the instruments that you play now, is that what you started out as, both of you?
Yes,
it is.
Yeah. Bass was always my first instrument and drums were his first. And then as we grew and like we're learning more, like we both learned keyboards and piano and stuff.
Yeah.
And he could play guitar. I'm not very good at guitar. I can kind of get around, but
yeah.
So I had this problem where, so our parents were divorced when we were growing up. That when we were 2 years old, they got divorced. So our dad's house was the musical house. That's where the studio was. That's where my drum set was. That's where we could like just hang out, play music, record it. Like we learned Pro Tools like it was a video game when we were young, you know? Like you never win, but you're always trying to get better and beat the game. But my mom's house, since I didn't have a drum set, I would just go take Kevin's guitar. And I taught myself how to play guitar. Me and Justin would jam in our bedroom on guitar and bass. And like I had a little practice pad drum kit in there, but it didn't do it for me. Like it just didn't feel right to practice that way.
So how can the drummer also get around on the guitar, but the bass player's not that good at guitar? I don't get that one.
I don't get it either. You know, it's a funny thing because like for some reason bar chords came really easy to me.
And yeah, just bar.
Justin can't bar chords at all.
But I can play Blackbird by the Beatles.
His flex is Blackbird. He can play it like perfectly and then put the guitar down and people are like, play more. And he's like, That's it.
Now, Justin, can you throw down a beat on the drums at all?
No.
I can't do the foot isolation and all that. Like,
yeah, I'm right there with you. I'm terrible at that. What was your first memory on TV? MTV, American Music Awards, Grammys, something where you saw something and said, I want to do that.
Okay. I honestly, a lot, but I think one of the biggest early ones that was a big influence on us was when Green Day put out Nimrod. They did an MTV concert called Live at the 10 Spot at the bottom of the hill in San Francisco. And it aired at like 10 p.m. at night. And I remember waiting.
It was past our bedtime.
It was past our bedtime. So we were like in bed with like a towel at the door, lights off, but like waiting for it to come on.
Yeah, VCR and, queued up to record VCR. It.
We recorded it on a VHS tape. And that one concert just, it had a ton of influence on us. Just the songs that they were doing, the energy of the crowd, their performances.
Also, they're just like not giving a fuck about being on MTV. Like you could see it when they'd be coming back from commercial. They'd be like, oh, are you guys ready for us? Like, are you recording? Like, because we're a punk band up here and we're ready to play. Like,
oh God. This next song's about speed. It just gets better. And if you're from the Bay Area, everybody knows what speed is.
It's like salt in the Bay Area.
You know, because... Yeah, and so recording that, watching it over and over again, seeing like a trio band, you know, just the three of them on stage making this like noise, this music with the energy of the crowd, they had such an impact on us.
Yeah, and you guys are like, I play drums, I play bass, and our other brother plays guitar. We could be a three-piece band.
Yeah.
And again, this is when they put out Nimrod, so we were already heavily into Dookie and Insomniac. They were all over the radio. They were like the biggest fucking band at the time.
And there's a part of that concert where Mike Durant, during She, he jumps and he hit his head on the ceiling. And his bass hit him in the face.
I remember that.
And he broke his nose and he didn't stop playing. He kept playing. He finished the song.
Gushing blood.
I was just like, that is the coolest thing ever. Nothing will stop them. They're just going to play the music.
Now, how old were you guys at this point? 90. This was 97.
That was 97.
We had to be like 8 years old.
Yeah, we had to be around eight. Yeah.
So you're young. You're young.
Yeah.
Because so like the first song we really learned on drums and bass was Brain Stew.
Eyes feel like they're gonna bleed. Right up and born till now my skull. My mouth is dry. My face is numb. Fucked up and spun out in my room. On my own, here we go.
Because for Justin, it, on bass, da-da, da-da, da-da,
yeah.
Da-da, da-da, da-da. It's a very rudimentary thing.
You think it was easy, but the space is the hardest part.
It is, yeah. That's the thing. People think the notes you play are the hardest thing, but it's the notes you don't play that are the hardest. Yeah.
The notes you don't play that the space is in time.
Exactly, yeah. And then for me on drums, like learning to isolate my foot from my hand with that drum beat was like huge progression. But because I was like 6 or 7 when I was learning that. So being able to like just play quarter notes with my right hand and the like doubles on my foot, that was a huge, huge part.
I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves here, but I mean to just to think at that age, did you ever fathom you'd be playing in a stadium with Green Day 25 years later?
Absolutely
never.
No.
Mind blowing.
And maybe that'll be a theme of this podcast, because it seems like every artist and musician that we admired growing up and we'd look up to and we'd buy tickets to go see their concerts, we're now friends with. Like, it's crazy how many of our favorite bands are now our peers, and they look at us with respect, and obviously we've respected them for so many years that it's a mind fuck.
It's hard to try to articulate what you just said. I still get nervous sometimes, weirdly, around the Descendants. You know, I'll be hanging out with them, and I'm like, they're my friends. They know me by name. They would invite me into their home. But like, it's still like I idolize these guys, you know. Yeah. And they became my peers and my friends. So now you're 8 years old. You see this. Do you have a drum set yet, Jesse? Do you have a bass, Justin?
Yes. Yes. I didn't actually be given my first bass on my own until my 9th birthday. But I remember that. It was too big. My dad traded in for a 3/4 size afterwards. Yeah.
Which you regret to this day.
I do regret. I wish I had the original American P bass that he got me.
And when did you guys start jamming, like with Kevin? And were you doing this in the house?
So from that early age, when he was 9 and we're 6 or whatever, he'd be like, learn this song. And like, we tried our best to play Green Day songs. We tried our best to just play whatever we heard on the radio. So like, even, you know, Smashing Pumpkins songs.
Sublime
songs. The K-Rock in LA and MTV were very much our tastemakers in the late 90s. Like,
sure,
a lot of our favorite bands were putting out music. Blink-182 putting out music videos and just killing it in the late 90s.
Well, I can't tell you how many times I've mentioned K-Rock in my podcast, how influential that was during this time. It was as influential as MTV in a lot of respects.
Yeah, the world-famous K-Rock, they say world-famous because it's true to the name. Like,
yeah,
My favorite little tidbit about K-Rock is them breaking Alanis Morissette. Like, she put out a record in Canada, she was nobody, and then K-Rock grabbed a hold of, like, her first single and fucking skyrocketed her career.
Yeah, same thing happened. Kevin Weatherly found her name by Goo Goo Dolls. And those guys have been, you know, hammering it out in the clubs for years and working their butts off and finally got their big break. So now you're you know, junior high, maybe early high school. Did you guys ever play in other bands without each other, without Kevin?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So starting in middle school, in like the 6th grade, we went to performing arts public schools. They were public schools, but they had great magnet programs and performing arts classes. So in 6th grade, we were both in like the concert band, where like I sat there, played a snare drum, and Justin sat in the back. You played electric bass.
I played electric there, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But that's when we started to learn how to read music, and you get a little bit of theory from that. But so this school, this was Milliken Middle School in Sherman Oaks. It also had, this is crazy, it had an extracurricular class after school on, I think it was Tuesdays. So from like 3:15 to 4:15, they had a class called Rock Band, which was,
oh, cool.
It wasn't a teacher who worked every day at the school. It was actually, he was the rhythm coach for the jazz band, but he'd stay after once a week and do Rock Band. And that was where, like, in the 6th grade, I showed up, and the 8th graders, since middle school, 6th, 7th, and 8th grade, the 8th graders were the seniors, technically. They gave me a CD and were like, learn these songs. And it, you know, it had Back in Black on it. It had, like, No Effects sticking in my eye on it. And, like, just a whole array of songs. It had Pennywise on it. And just this collection of different music that these kids, like, 2 years older than me, are like, learn these songs so we could play them after class or whatever. And so that's where we started jamming with those kids. And from that, I joined a band with these other three kids that were a year above me. I played drums. Justin couldn't be in the band because there was already a bass player and two guitar players. But that band lasted for like 3-4 years, and we would play the talent shows at school. There was a center quad at our middle school called the Eighth Grade Lawn, which was exclusive to eighth graders. But we were friends with the eighth graders, so we could hang out there. But we got to play on that stage for the school, like during lunch hour.
I got a question for you, Jesse. So yeah. you're in this band, and they already have a bass player. Did you ever think to yourself, you're back there, and you're like, man, this groove isn't locking like it would lock with my brother?
Maybe. But I was so young, and I still was like, yeah, I guess I was good for my age, but I still didn't have that type of forethought of being like, oh, this is so groovy, or like, we're really locking in. It was more like, do I sound good? I don't really care how the other people sound. Like, we didn't have that cohesiveness. And like, even now, sometimes I'll dig up a couple of those recordings, because again, having the luxury of a recording studio at our dad's house, our band practices were technically just recording sessions. Like, we'd show up and write a song and record it, and they sound like garbage nowadays, but you know, for a couple, you know, 10, 11, 12 year olds.
And did you guys, along with your brother, Kevin, did you ever have a band together before Interrupters? And what was the name of that band?
Yeah, we did try. We had a trio. We just called it Bavona.
But that was during the Telecasters years.
Yeah, it was.
So the band we were in before Interrupters, where we went on the Sugar Ray tour and we met Amy in the 2009, that was a band called Telecasters. That, I did not play drums. Justin did not play bass. Justin played keyboards. Mm-hmm. And I played rhythm guitar. Kevin was the lead guitar player. And then our friends Dash Hutton and Tim Hutton, also brothers, were the drummer and lead singer and bass player and lead singer, respectively.
And what years were this? Was this around maybe 2009, 2010?
Yeah, so we got the call from the drummer Dash around Christmas of 07, saying, hey.
Okay.
Because Kevin was already in this band, and they were called Hutton Brothers. It was just a trio of them, but they ran an iPod that had a left side click track for the drummer, and the right side had keyboard tracks, extra guitar parts, extra vocal tracks. And that's how they played shows. Like, they just run an iPod, and the three of them would play the tracks, basically. And okay. I remember Dash calling us around Christmas time, 07, we're on break. We were in college at the time, but like, not into college. We didn't want to go to college. We were working.
I
feel like we're jumping around, because the whole journey from like middle school music classes to high school music classes, and then being like, you're going to go to college and keep doing these music classes. You got to learn jazz and play jazz and listen to jazz, and you're not listening to the right jazz. The straw that really broke the camel's back was this piss poor attitude by like our fellow peers about, you're not listening to the right jazz, or you're not listening to the right music, period.
Yeah. And in college, the whole music thing seemed like a competition among the students, which wasn't our vibe for music. It was supposed to be like a fun collective thing you did together. And it just wasn't what we were looking for.
Yeah. So we really got that phone call from Dash at the end of the first semester, where we were like trying to figure out what to do. We were working as PAs at a video production company, which was awesome. But we were trying to do music. So he called and was like, hey, we're playing the Viper Room in 2 months. Jesse, you're going to play guitar. Justin, you're going to play keys. Can you guys sing? We're like, no. He's like, we'll teach you how to sing. we'll come over for Christmas Eve, and we'll hang out and talk, and then we'll book some rehearsals. That was the start of that band for us.
For nearly four decades, JMK Security Solutions has provided protection for homes and businesses. I know firsthand. I'm Jeff Beckman, and with my wife, Kim, we started JMK Security Solutions. Our attention to detail, service after the sale, and product knowledge are the foundation of our success. JMK Security has routinely been recognized as the best of Madison for security companies. We expect that trend to continue as the next generation, our son Jeffrey, takes over as president. Let us protect what is valuable to you. JKSecurity.com.
Well, a little bit ago, I was being facetious when I was saying, why? Why didn't you want to go to college? I mean, I think all of us musicians that were you know, contemplating or were in college, at some point, I'd be staring at a wall at some logic class at the University of Florida, and the whole time I'm thinking about the, you know, my show that night. So
right,
I know right where you guys are at mentally with that. And of course, those petty jealousies and things, the high school thing, because we had a class like Rock Band called Instrumental Techniques that I was in. Terrible name, but it was actually a class. It was 5 days a week, like a history class or anything else you took. So I have wonderful memories from that. But let's jump to when you guys were doing the Telecasters thing. How did it come about that you were on tour with Sugar Ray? I believe you ended up playing with Mark McGrath Sugar Ray. Is that correct?
Right, that is correct. This all goes to Kevin's connections. So like, Kevin started playing in the Transplants in 2005. He got that gig by auditioning, and he was the touring keyboard player for the Transplants. And through that, not only did he meet Travis Barker, Tim Armstrong, and start working with them in the studio, but he met the Road Crew. So, and that Road Crew is such a tight-knit group. That's, you know, that's where he met Daniel Jensen, who was Travis's drum tech. And he's like my fucking fairy god drum tech. Godmother, father, whatever. You know, like, he's given me so much support drum wise that I don't have enough good things to say about that guy. But him and a bunch of other people that would then, once Kevin was done being the keyboard player for Transplants, he started being a roadie, and he would guitar tech, he would drum tech, he would be the Pro Tools operator for things. Like, he would take any touring gig he could get. And so through that,
I gotta stop you real quick. Yeah. I've seen your brother. I mean, he's a team player. You guys all are. You know, I saw him out with Rancid. He's running back and forth. You know, he's got his keyboard set up, but he's working on the guitar amps, and he's making sure the drums are good. He's just a team player, you know? So it's no surprise the chain of events that are happening here and why you guys got so many opportunities. It's because of the work you put in.
Yeah, and it all comes from playing in bands. So, like, going back to being in middle school and playing in that band, like, we're 12-year-old kids. When we have a gig, like, I have to lug my drum set. Like, our dad had a PA that we could borrow, so, like, if we had to go play a gig somewhere, we'd be bringing a PA with us too, bringing a drum set. We were,
and then that's where I would come in when I wasn't playing. I would run the PA.
Exactly. Justin would be the roadie. He'd be the 13-year-old roadie with my shitty little pop punk band.
And then
that carried all the way still through high school. Like, high school was where we started playing in a actual ska band, where it was more the Jamaican sound, and we were trying to play traditional ska. We had a really good friend who's just had all the 45s, just this deep, deep, vast knowledge of Jamaican music. So we'd play ska, rocksteady, reggae. And it was one of those things, like, at the time we were like, we're doing all right. And now when I look back, I'm like, we actually were pretty good for a couple teenagers. And it, also, that band was lifelong friends. Like, we're still close with them. They're kids that we met in elementary school. So to this day, they're friendships that we've had for two decades.
That's awesome. So how long did your tenure with Sugar Ray last? How long did you play with them, and like approximately how many gigs, you think?
Well, so we started guitar teching for them. We were stage left and stage right for them starting in 2010, and then we started playing drum and bass for them in 2012.
Now, Interrupters had already begun. You guys started in 2011. Your first record was 2014.
Right.
So you're kind of being pulled in two directions here. Where was your mindset then? Like, we got this band, but we got this gig that we're, you know, making money from.
It was an interesting predicament for like a 22-year-old kid, because on one hand, you want to be in your own band, especially with like your family, where you know there's a lot of potential there. And on the other hand, Sugar Ray was the best gig we've ever had. Like, not even when we were playing for them, when we were teching for them, like, the people, the vibe. Honestly, they were one of the bands that we grew up listening to. So just hearing the songs every night was emotional for us sometimes. To be like, I'm standing on stage and they're playing Fly. Like, how did I get here? And I've had that type of emotion with almost every band I've gotten to be a roadie for, like Rancid. I'd be on the side of the stage in Belgium at Groz Rock, and they're playing Ruby Soho, and I'd like have a tear coming down my eye, like, oh my god, I can't believe I'm standing. Oh shit, does Tim need a guitar change? Oh no, he's good. Okay. But like,
yeah,
you know,
yeah, that is so it's so cool to hear you say that, because I can relate to that so well. You know, I've talked about it a little bit ago. You never ever think that you're going to meet your heroes, let alone be working for them or be friends with them. It's crazy.
Exactly. Man, I feel like we're jumping around a little bit.
This is perfect, because now we're really leading into, or getting into, when do you stop Sugar Ray and say, we're just doing Interrupters?
In 2012, Sugar Ray did a big summer tour. It was called Summerland. It was Everclear, Sugar Ray, Marcy Playground, Lit, and the Gym Blossoms. Huge '90s nostalgia tour. Yeah. And it was our first big tour. And we were spoiled. Condo bunks on a bus. And we're in one of the headliner bands. And we're 22 at the time.
Before this, we had done little jaunts. I wouldn't call them tours, but like that Telecasters tour that we met Amy on. It was a short 1 week tour where we went like up to Northern California.
In a minivan.
It was a Econoline.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Remember we had the Nook?
Yeah, yeah.
There was like no seatbelts. but we went up to just Northern California into like Arizona, and that was that. So it wasn't too far of a tour.
Right.
But this Summerland tour with Sugar Ray 2012, nationwide tour, it was like over 30 shows. It's spoiled right off the bat. Like,
well, for the listeners, Justin just said condo bunks. And what a condo bunk means is the bunk configuration in the middle of the bus. You could basically sit up in a condo bunk. But when you're going in style, you probably had a couple buses out there where you could afford to do that, you know, because usually you got to shove 10 or 12 guys in a bus and the bunks are really close to one another. So you're out there feeling like you're spoiled. You get back in the van with the interrupters.
Oh, not like, feeling whoa. It. Knowing, being like walking into it, being like, okay, I know, this is a great paycheck, but also just the way we're being treated physically and emotionally, like, spoiled right off the bat.
And
like,
the crew let us know it. They were friendly and nice, but they broke our balls all the time about, like,
22-year-old kids just jumping into a gig like this.
So we did that tour in 2012, and they were going to do a similar tour in 2013, and we were just like, oh, we're going to do that again. But then 2013 was when the Interrupters were starting to tour more, and then there was we got an offer to do the Rancid Transplants tour in the summer. What was two legs? It was Rancid Transplants, one leg, and then Rancid and Tim Timebomb and Friends. And we were part of Tim Timebomb and Friends. And our heads in 22 were like, oh, we have this tour that we can go make money on. But it was like, no, we're gonna leave Sugar Ray. It was great. We're gonna go get in a van with our family, start this band, and do what we really love, which is something that we can claim as our own.
Yeah, and it was it was one of those like family conversations too. And Tim was part of the conversation, and Tim had our back. He's like totally understood, but he's like, look, you guys need to do this tour if you want this band to really like move forward. And also, as if it's like work that you're worried about, I got your back, guys. Like, I have plenty of things I could hire you to do. And so Tim Timebomb and Friends is one of those where like we did a lot of studio sessions with him, recording songs with him. And then that tour, we were double dipping. We'd open the show with the Interrupters, and then we'd go out and play another 45 minutes with Tim Timebomb and Friends.
So you guys are running sound. You're doing anything anybody asks you. Hey, the dressing room needs more water. You're going to take a case in there. You're going to set up your drums.
Team
player. You're going to do sessions with Tim Timebomb. You're going to go over here and work with Sugar Ray. But all the while you're doing that, you're honing your craft in so many ways. And the other thing, and don't take this the wrong way, the very first time I saw your band, which would have been 2013 maybe, 2012, I was just like, oh, this band's going to be huge. And it didn't happen overnight for you. And I think it's probably the best thing that could have ever happened. The last 10 years, you've just become you were already a great band, but where you've come in 10 years, and you've done everything. You've played every dump to every arena, everything in between. And all those little experiences, you know, add up to where you're at now. But I remember seeing you the first time, just how tight the band was. And like, now forget about it. It's just, you know, you guys as a rhythm section with Kevin, it's incredible. You know, I have you guys on this week because we had Kevin and Amy on and talking to them and just the memories of those early days, seeing you again, I was like, this band is just going to be massive. It was every time I saw you, there was more people. So now you're getting into the first record's out. You're out on the road. I want to say the first tour you did some dates with Less Than Jake. Is that right?
It's true. That was the first big, serious, long form tour for us. Because right when we put the record out, we went out with the Mighty Mighty Bosstones for about a week and a half. And that was mostly West Coast. It was like Denver and Vegas and Arizona and California. So again, it was like a short, maybe it was 2 weeks. But that was where we rented a van from a company in LA. It was a Sprinter van, had a TV built into it. And it cost us every penny we made on that tour. We came home from a 2 week tour thinking we were going to all make a little bit of money. And there was no money left.
I think we owed money.
The van cost like over $4,000 for the 2 weeks. And we were like, this is not scalable. So Kevin took out a huge loan and we bought a van at the end of 2014. And so this is where long-term thinking starts coming into play. Because if we want to keep touring at this scale, we need our own van. We can't be paying rent on something, because that just doesn't work.
I don't think a lot of bands realize, you know, you get on an opening gig for, let's say, Less Than Jake, you're the first band out of four. I mean, you're lucky if you're making $200 a night.
Yeah.
That doesn't go very far. I mean, if you're getting a hotel, you're getting one room, people are sleeping on floors, you're asking to stay at people's houses because you can't afford a place to stay. You got gas, you have oil changes, everything else, food.
Yeah. So, on that Less Than Jake tour, we were sharing one room. It was, I believe, it was just five of us, six of us.
There were six of us on that tour.
Six of us. It was the four band, and then we had our friend Sid out as our stage tech, and our friend Nick Danger, who was our driver and merch. And so the six of us would share one room. Like, we had two blow-up mattresses that, like, Nick and Sid would get, and then me and Justin would share a bed, Kevin and Amy would share a bed. And that was the whole tour, booking Econolodge rooms for $50 a night. You could smoke in those rooms. People have probably been murdered.
You could do whatever you want in those rooms.
Yeah. And just trying to
just check out on time.
Yeah. Just check out on time. And so, you know, trying to save as much money as possible while earning the little bit of amount of money we were. And, but that first tour that we did with you was, I just want to explain it for everybody, because we started in Vancouver, I believe, or
it was Washington State, but
But we ended up going from Vancouver all the way to Montreal, stopping about 10 times along the way through Canada, and then we said goodbye to you. Well, we went down to the East Coast, upstate New York. Yeah, upstate.
And then
New York.
Went down to South Carolina.
Yeah, and then we said goodbye to you at Fest. Like, we went down and we played pre-Fest and did a pool party for Fest and another little club show at Fest. And then we jumped on a 7 Seconds tour and came back down through the South, like through Texas and stuff. And so we were gone for 8 weeks.
Did like over 40 shows.
And did over 40 shows, six of us in a van.
And we still say that was the tour that could have broken us. It almost did. I mean, I did break my ankle on it.
I do remember that. And I'll tell you something else. Canada is unforgiving with the drives. The mountains out west, you know, going from like Vancouver over to Edmonton and Calgary is insane. We were in a bus. You're doing it in a van.
Yeah.
That was brutal. If you can make it through a winter tour in Canada in a van, you have some perseverance. But, you know, you guys did the first record in 2014. You did Say It Out Loud in 2016. You did the third record in 2018. Of course, as I mentioned on the podcast with Amy and Kevin, you probably would have had music out sooner, but the pandemic happened.
Absolutely.
But all that while that all this is going on, I'm watching you. I'm watching the band from afar. You know, by the second record, now you're starting to go to Europe. Now you're starting to go to Japan, other places, you know, and you're biting off pieces, getting on these bigger tours, the snowball's going. And then, of course, we talked about it a little bit ago, you're on the stadium tour. And unfortunately, it got postponed, but then it did happen. And I'm just going to ask you right now, everything we've talked about, you know, your earliest memories of seeing Green Day on TV, everything that's happened in between, now you're playing stadiums. Like, is there one memory that stands out for either one of you individually or together?
From the stadium tour?
No, just from everything that we spoke of. Because you don't get much bigger than playing with your idols in a stadium. How do you top that?
You can't. You befriend them and then you hang out at Thanksgiving.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, you call them and just check to see how their kid's doing or something. Like, it's, yeah, you can't really go bigger than that. Like,
okay, well, now there is one. So Green Day took us to South America, and one of the shows was in Buenos Aires. And we're on the side of the stage getting ready. We're like 5 minutes out from our set time. And Jesse peeks out to the audience.
Wait, this wasn't Buenos Aires. This was in Sao Paulo. This is Brazil.
Oh. Are you sure?
I'm pretty sure.
No, Buenos Aires was Buenos Aires was the one where we couldn't. So, peeked out and saw the audience, but you couldn't see the back of the audience.
Yeah, it was just heads, sea of heads.
And you could almost see the curvature of the earth where the audience ended. It just faded away. And it was the first, not the only time, because there's always nerves, but it's one of those times where you get all the nerves where you're like, oh no. Yeah,
like your stomach drops, your heart starts racing, and you go, oh my God, what? I have to walk out and play in front of all these people.
But the photos, there are photos from that show that our friend Sarah got from behind like the amp line, where you can see us looking back at her with the crowd, and the looks on all of our faces is just pure joy and just being astounded. because we couldn't believe it. Like, there was more than 30 or 40,000 people in this audience, and we were up there on this stage, and they're all looking at you.
Yeah. And not just looking, they knew some of the lyrics. There were people there that did their research. Like, and that is a testament to a lot of the bands that we have played with and their fan bases, because some people go to concerts and all they want to do is see their favorite band. But some people go to concerts for the whole experience, and they go, who's the opening band? I need to look into them because I want to get my whole ticket's worth. You know?
I think that has something to do with the punk background, you know, that we come from.
Yeah, so going out there and like Amy's getting him to sing along, and we do, like, you know, at the end of, back then our big song was Family, and getting them to just sing This Is My Family back to us.
Yeah.
Like, we literally would bring a tear to all of our eyes on stage, and then we'd walk off and just be like, on cloud nine.
That's so awesome. Well, before we wrap up here, I have to ask, and you know, I can't think of one musician I've ever met. I don't believe maybe a minuscule fraction of people ever thought that, you know, or wanted to do this for money. Okay. I know you're not doing it for money, but aside from, I'd like my musical career to go on and support me, pay my bills, and maybe let me take a vacation in a half a year. You know, I want to make money from this. Besides that, is there anything left that you want to do as musicians? Because, man, like I said, the last 10 years, I mean, you guys are truly living the dream right now. The tours that you're getting, the buzz that is on this band. You know, I was telling my producer, Chris, I said, we got to get Kevin back on with Amy, because I had Kevin on about a year ago. I said, this band's going to blow up and they're not going to do our show. Not that you'd be too good for us, that you're going to be too darn busy. And I really feel that. I really feel that for you guys. What else is there besides everything you've been through? If you could just say one thing that you'd still like to accomplish as musicians.
Well, I mean, you know, when you perform and the audience has like a deep connection to a song, like Amy gets a lot of people that say like, your lyrics really helped me through troubling times, or your music saved my life. That never gets old. If that happens for eternity, and that's the only thing that ever happens when you play the songs, that's worth it in itself.
And even if it's just one person per tour or one person per year, like it all it takes is that one fan to make a strong connection for it to be all worth it.
I do believe music can save the world. To a degree. But it's important to a lot of people. And that one feeling, like, it never gets old. And you're never like, oh, I've heard it before. It's always something really deep and personal. And that connection is kind of what you go out on the road, and why we make music is to, you know, you help other people with your music.
Well, you guys are my friends. I respect the living heck out of both of you. And thank you for taking us on your journey today.
Yeah, thanks for having us, Chris. We love you too.
And you're so important to our journey, like, especially with the Interrupters, because not only did we do that big tour in 2014, but we've played countless shows in the States. We've done some European shows together. And your fan base has always accepted us. Your band has always accepted us. And I love your band so much. Yeah. Dude, you and Roger's harmonies, like, one of my favorite things to just sit there and watch. And then, like, you know, Buddy and JR's horn parts are they probably are my favorite ska horn duo. Like, the lines they write and the way they play them, so tasteful. I don't have enough good things to say. I mean, I have too many good things to say about you guys.
Well, I appreciate everything you said, and back at you tenfold. And once again, thanks so much. The listeners are going to love this.
Oh, I hope so, man. Thank you for having us. It's been fun.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com, and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Hello, Tom May here, host of Future Friday. I've spent the last 15 years on the road with my band, The Menzingers, where I've met all kinds of wild and fascinating people. So I started a podcast. On Future Friday, I talk to fellow musicians about the moments that made them, their passions outside of music, and the curiosities that tie us all together. I've also talked to the likes of UFO researchers, magicians, soldiers, and documentary filmmakers, and I'm constantly searching for folks that can shape and change our view of the world. You can check out Future Friday wherever you like.